Get an 11% rebate at Menards. Rust-Oleum Stops Rust custom 5-in-1 spray paint lets you choose from 5 spray patterns with a twist of the dial. It protects indoor and outdoor metal and wood projects for long-lasting results and is available in more than 40 colors. Get started on your painting project at Menards, number one in customer satisfaction among home improvement retailers according to J.D. Power. For more information, visit jdpower.com/awards.
Hey everybody, my name is Jesse Collings, and I want to tell you all about my show, the Gentleman's Wrestling Podcast, here on the Voices of Wrestling Podcast Network. On the Gentleman's Wrestling Podcast, we do a thorough analysis on the biggest issues and trends within the pro wrestling industry. We talk a lot about pro wrestling media, we talk a lot about fan culture and wrestling's place within general pop culture, and we talk about the broader influences that are shaping the way we discuss and analyze the pro wrestling industry. We've had some of the brightest minds in the pro wrestling intelligentsia on the show, including WrestleNomics host Brandon Thurston, both Rich Kreich and Joe Lanza from the Flagship Wrestling Podcast, Trevor Dame from the Through the Years podcast, and a whole lot more. This isn't a show for hot takes. It's not a show recapping the latest episode of television. This is a show focusing on the biggest topics in pro wrestling and doing a deep dive on the real stories behind the surface level analysis you might find elsewhere. The Gentleman's Wrestling Podcast is available wherever you get your podcasts, and we'd really appreciate it if you gave us a try. Thanks.
This podcast is a member of the Voices of Wrestling Podcasting Network. Visit voicesofwrestling.com to hear the rest of our great podcasts, as well as show reviews, columns, opinions, and updates across the world of wrestling.
Kids, this week, Indiana is all about WWE and the Lazy River, a Forbidden Door preview, and Invader Club, Kawada versus Albright. Do you like wrestling? Well, we like wrestling too. This is Shake Them Ropes. I am Jeff Hawkins, experimenting with the open yet again. He is Chris Novembrino.
I'm experimenting with marijuana yet again. I gotta tell you, this...
We get flagged a little bit for that, but that's okay.
This is very promising. I think this is working out.
Is this getting you through the week? Yeah.
It's really keeping my head calm.
Maybe I just need to like pour myself a stiff drink and just somehow try and make it through the show.
Wait, who's flagging us?
Oh, YouTube.
Oh, YouTube. Oh,
when it watches you smoke, it's like, we got to flag that. Okay, cool, whatever. Usually, it's not that bad, but, you know, whatever. You ruined my bit, by the way, because you came in with a Vader Club reference. I didn't think you were going to have one.
No.
I was going to tell the people how much you don't care about them. I was going to bury you. This sucks.
No, it's better than this. This is extremely on brand. I am the kid who showed up to class with the project that he pulled together in the last 10 minutes on the bus and got a B+.
It's like my thesis. yeah, no, because it was like, I ask you all week, give me a Vader Club suggestion. Give me a Vader Club suggestion. Give me a Vader. Please, for the love of God, Chris, I've hated all this wrestling this week. Give me a Vader Club suggestion. And you're just like, hey, let's go in 15 minutes if you can. It's like, no, I can't. I'm at work, Chris. And give me a Vader Club suggestion so I can watch it at lunch. No,
then,
I'm not going
to
do that.
And then one finally came to me. it's tough because it's like, all right, we've done Shamrock. I've done Vader. I've got a few other ones up my sleeve, but like I didn't feel like pulling the Muta match or something yet. And so I wanted to get someone who it was always been like a mainstay on my VPW2 cartridge, and I've had a million matches with in virtual reality, but I've only watched a handful of matches in reality of, and that's Gary Albright. And
I know so little about him, so this will be fun. But we gotta pay attention to some little downer of a bit of news. Sika the Wild Samoans passing away this week, aka Roman Reigns' father, one half of Afa and Sika, of course, the Wild Samoans, big time team in the 70s and 80s. I came to them relatively late because my WWF fandom, because, you know, you couldn't get WWF unless you had cable where I was. So that was mostly the mid 80s. And by then he had, I'm reading now from Wrestling Observer, Sika returned as a singles wrestler in August 1986. Managed by the Wizard, a.k.a. King Curtis Iaukea, and later Mr. Fuji, and often teaming with Kamala. God, I remember that. That team ended when Kamala quit. He was introduced coming out of the ocean with a large fish in his mouth and started eating the raw fish, although mostly chewed and spit it out. Thank you, Dave. But yes, I remember that bit. And then here's another one. I just, if you want to really go read in-depth and serious, go read Dave Meltzer's obituary of him. He always does a great job with obituaries. He basically, everything from almost his birth to like 5 minutes before he died. That's a Dave Meltzer obituary in the Wrestling Observer. But Sika was a kind of enforcer type, famously roughing up Bam Bam Bigelow when the feeling was that Bigelow was getting too cocky. He was a veteran heel, but at this stage of the game, he was mostly there to put over the top baby faces. He left the company after WrestleMania 4 on March 27, 1988. Man, there's a guy that I'm glad finally had a career in the mid to late 90s. It's Bam Bam Bigelow, because he goes to WWF. He gets roughed up by Sika, and then he jumps to the NWA. He jumps to Crockett and flares on camera, calling him Fat Boy and saying, oh, yeah, you don't, you know, we don't wrestle like those wussies up there north and stuff. And Bam Bam Bigelow was just getting it from all ends, but back
and
to...
he was awesome in his own
way.
He absolutely had like the look at the menace and totally worked as a top level heel,
but not to go off on too much of a tangent, do you have any remembrances of the Wild Samoans?
Not particularly they were a little bit before my time, and they were always a middle of the card sort of thing, like, you know, they
I believe Lou Albano also,
right yeah. Like, I'm familiar with them as an act, but I feel like I watched them have, you know, a match against the Bushwhackers, I'm sure.
Oh, maybe in that later stage, or when they were like mixing them up, but I mean the original, like Afa and Sika were on their way out when I was getting into it, and that's when they had the British Bulldogs and the Hart Foundation were just coming in, and all those other great tag teams. I always kind of thought, you know, they're great, but they're a little bit up there or whatever. But
right. I mean, for me, like the sort of quintessential Samoan tag team still sort of remains the Faces of Fear. Like Meng and the Barbarian, even though, like, you know, the Samoan lineage, they just sort of did it, that gimmick. I think no one did it better than those two.
Right, but Afa and Sika are probably the blueprint for the gimmick. You know, mm-hmm. The two guys, and yeah, you know, the jingoistic. We found these two savages in the wilds of Samoa, and they're, you know, headhunters, and they do cannibalism and all these other things. And then from there, they begat, like, the Samoan SWAT team, and Yokozuna, when he was known in world-class championship wrestling as Coquinas Maximus. You know, that giant guy, you know, the Samoan Savage, and the Islanders even, you know, Haku and Tama, and later the Tonga Kid, and then, of course, you know, the Usos and Rikishi and
now
Samu and Fatu and all
Tongaloa,
those.
Tongaloa, Taloa, Longaloa, Hong Kongaloa.
Yes. Also passing away this week, Jamie Kellner, whose career included being part of the creation of both the Fox and WB broadcast networks, but who also changed the history of wrestling as a guy who essentially led to the pulling the plug on WCW. You've been watching the death of WCW on Vice, that terrible program. As I described it, death of WCW on Vice is like Murder on the Orient Express. If each of the suspects / murderers had a podcast, because that's what it is.
It's if you took Murder on the Orient Express and combined it with Rashomon and then hit it with a shuffle to make it much dumber than either of those two things.
Yes, I just like everybody's blaming Keller. It's like giving these, you know, it gave Eric Bischoff like a redemption arc. I'm like, get out of here with that crap. It's like, no, I'm not watching that. But Kellner was hired to replace Ted Turner at the start of March 2001, just over 2 months after Turner Broadcasting had announced a sale of WCW to Fusion Media, a company that was put together to take over the company by both Eric Bischoff and Brian Bedall. And that, of course, fell through. Kellner's power would be all over programming on TBS, TNT, the WB, CNN, the Cartoon Network, TNT Sports, as well as overseeing the Atlanta Braves, Atlanta Hawks, and Atlanta Thrashers. Kellner's decision publicly was the idea that they felt wrestling didn't attract affluent enough viewers. Jim Weiss at TBS said about the decision, quote, basically, we've decided that professional wrestling in its current incarnation is not consistent with the upscale brands we've built at TNT and TBS. Therefore, we will not be carrying it. This was when basically TBS and TNT totally, when they sold the AOL, they totally revamped their network images because TBS was the most hillbilly network.
Right.
You could, like, Andy Griffith played on that thing like 20 times a day. Like, if there was a rain delay for the Braves, like,
starting 5 minutes late was weird and rednecky and pastoral.
Well, yeah, but that was to that was for ratings reasons.
Yeah, but even that was like their own thing now.
Yeah, and that was individualistic. Yeah, that was them being contrarian in their own way. 6:05 Eastern on the Superstation.
Yes.
Type of a thing. But Turner was always the, you know, wrestling. Turner always thought, yeah, wrestling built this network, so we should always have wrestling on this network. And Jamie Kellner came in there and goes, no, we want the upscale clientele. We're going to play Surviving the Game 20 times in one weekend on Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. Yeah, they'd be doing stuff like that. And they had Thursday Night Football. They had the NBA at that time because TNT was really the first network other than broadcast to carry on cable to carry the NBA for any length of time. And at that time they were playing like Marx Brothers movies before they'd play at like a West Coast game or something. It was a total revamp. It was a revamp to get into the 90s/early aughts. And
a bizarre era in advertisement where the conventional advertising wisdom was that lower class people don't buy stuff. So how could you possibly sell that?
Those poor don't have money. The hell with that.
Besides that, there aren't even that many of them. So how could you possibly sell things?
These are not the Glengarry leads I was told about. No, yeah, it's... what was I going to say? Because there's something weird. I mean, yeah, it's always like everybody does this, though. Oh, we don't want those common folks coming in here. That's all LA real estate is based on. There's no like real affordable apartment complex. No, we want the upscale people with the money. You know, young Hollywood will come here and rent this place for $6,000 a month because it has a view of the Hollywood sign or something. And it's like, no.
Everybody should just have more money.
Yeah, that's pretty much what it is. I don't blame Kellner. I mean, if you watched WCW at that time, WCW also sucked. This was like new blood versus the millionaires. This was not
a company that was going to be saved by a new ownership team. Like, even if Bischoff and his partner had managed to pull off the deal with Fusient, they still had a very crappy show that had, and a brand that was brutally damaged by the finger poke of doom and Vince Russo coming out and announcing a page one reset of the entire history of the company.
Yeah.
I mean, like, there have been so many things that had taken WCW from not a prestige brand in the early 90s, because it certainly wasn't, but from a brand where it was relevant 96, 97, 98 to being something that was as irrelevant as it was in the early 90s, if not more so.
Yeah, I just, it's like, all these things about, you know, Bischoff could have saved WCW. Bischoff was all in on Hogan still. As the savior of wrestling, because, you know, well, look at the ratings or whatever, man. People had
dude, if he had understood what utility Hollywood Hulk Hogan brought to WCW and had utilized the Hollywood Hulk Hogan character to its logical conclusion, Starrcade of 1997, and then basically sent Hogan packing after this one last very long title reign, thus leaving the belt to Sting and really setting up the new Sting era or whatever. That would have been one thing, but he never understood what the limits of Hulk Hogan was. Well, as a character,
I'm because like in the early in 94, I think is when they signed Hogan. People in WCW were still very loyal to the kind of Crockett brand of wrestling. And okay, whatever. And then we have this invasion angle that starts in 95 with the NWO type thing.
96.
I'm sorry. Well, yeah, it's all a blur.
it's summer of 96.
Because 95, yeah. they had basically exhausted the Vince McMahon template of Hogan in WCW.
Hogan was getting booed. He was already getting
Hogan.
Booed.
They sacrificed the Horsemen to Hogan. Vader. All of them. They sacrificed the Dungeon of Doom to Hogan, and they sacrificed Vader to Hogan. And so we get this NWO thing, and the answer to that is to have WCW finally get rid of Hulk Hogan. That's the answer. That's how you get the company back, is you basically say, yes, we are superior to WWF as opposed to this faux WWF that we have here. And they never could get that through their thick effing skulls. I just could not believe that. Then it just became offshoots of NWO and... We're going to give the NWO their own show. It's just like, what?
There is totally an alternative universe where Vader comes back, like, rebranded as the Mastodon on a motorcycle and, like, starts just beating up the NWO week after week on his crusade to get the title back from Hogan and take the company back. Like, after everyone else has failed, here comes Vader.
You know, maybe after, like, Hennig turns on the Horseman, then Vader becomes, like, the actual fourth Horseman and comes back and takes Arn's spot and kills some dudes. I'm here for that. Anyways.
Also, I'm here for Ric Flair managing Vader. That actually would be,
that actually would be awesome, to be honest with you. WWE getting into the Indiana business. Officially announced its multi-year deal with Indiana Sports Corporation that will bring one WrestleMania, one SummerSlam, and one Royal Rumble to Lucas Oil Stadium in Indianapolis. The official first date of the deal is the 2025 Royal Rumble on February 1st. Both the WrestleMania and SummerSlam events will be two nights, so whether the first two-day SummerSlam is in 2025 or 2026, already announced as a two-day event in Minneapolis, this does show the plan is two nights for both shows going forward. Meh. The deal, which runs from 2025 to 2032, is not just for the three events, as the state will be paying WWE to run Raw, SmackDown, NXT, and other live events as part of the deal in both Indianapolis as well as throughout the state of Indiana, including regular shows in Fort Wayne and Evansville, Hawkins, Crank, Brockway, Ogdenville, and North Haverbrook have not been booked quite yet, but... Yeah, it looks like this whole plan by TKO to have people pay for you to come to them, Indiana and Indianapolis, which is possibly the most boring metro area in America. Good steakhouses, not much else. But yeah, what do you think of Indiana getting in the WWE business, Chris?
So upon seeing the announcement, the first thing that came to mind was a quote from Deep Thoughts by Jack Handy. And it is, to paraphrase it, they say that God lives inside of all of us. And if he does, I hope he likes burritos because that's what he's going to get. And that is how I feel about Indianapolis and wrestling. I hope they like it because that is what they are going to get and a lot of it. On one level, I think that WrestleMania for Indianapolis is probably a quality investment for the city. That having people like international tourists on that scale probably is more or less unheard of for Indianapolis other than race fans. And this will give them something else. Also, you have race fans there, and there's definitely a cross-section of car enthusiasts, motorsports enthusiasts, and wrestling enthusiasts. So I think that there is some utility in this. But that being said, Indiana is not a particularly populous state. So as you're quipping with the Simpsons references from the monorail episode, we are talking about East Podunk, North Haverbrook, Northampton 2. They ran out of names, so they just...
You know who's getting very angry right now, by the way, Chris, is Rob McCarron, who's from Indiana.
Like, look, he can go out into a cornfield and scream. I hear that's what they do out there when they get angry or sad.
NXT in Gary, Indiana, gang capital of America.
Right. Gary, Indiana, yes, one of the worst, most declining cities of the country. I think there's a lot of economic opportunity in Indiana. And by opportunity, I mean crisis, and that sometimes crisis is just an opportunity in disguise if you really think about it.
One of the strangest stories was the announcement of a combined Dynamite and Collision taping on August 21st in Cardiff, Wales at the Utilita Arena. They had pushed that Wembley Stadium would be the only show of the year in Europe until last week when this show was announced. Strange thing is that while the show was announced by the company in social media, it was never announced on television, and pre-sale tickets were put on sale this week. One reader who lives in the area, this is from the Observer, of course, noted to us that he had no idea there was even a show until he saw social media posts complaining about how high the tickets prices are. AEW doing AEW things, Chris.
I think I think that AEW has a very interesting way of booking and promoting their shows. And I was actually thinking about that a lot as I was watching this week's episode of Dynamite. So I don't want to get too into my review here, but Dynamite was sure interesting on that front too. They have a weird way of getting you excited for what they're doing.
Well, you're getting excited for something they're doing. It's just not the thing you're supposed to be getting excited about. That's for next week. Let's see. What's next? John Swicata, I think is how you say the name, has replaced Ryan Callahan as head writer of SmackDown. Callahan, who had been head writer for the show since 2020, has left the company. We're told that Callahan was considered a very talented writer, but wasn't as well liked as the leader of the group. I can confirm he took heat for Jennifer Pepperman leaving, although I think her leaving is more Mercedes Moné got her into AEW. This is Dave editorializing. It was also said it became harder for underneath talent to reach him. I was told by somebody else that Triple H didn't quite care for Ryan Callahan either. And there were a few writers who have had some issues with one Ryan Callahan. Interesting, though, because they're on their hottest streak, and this past 4 years of SmackDown have been quite good. And so I'm a little, like, I get getting along to get along, and I don't know anything about this, to be honest with you, so I'm kind of talking out of my butt, to be honest with you, but I'm also a don't change horses if things are working type of person.
Totally. I mean, the one thing, and again, we're not there, so I don't know, but the one thing that does make me think that maybe this was a necessary departure is that he had seeming dislike from above and below.
Yeah.
And that makes you a bad adjunct then, sort of definitionally.
Yeah, you're kind of getting it both ways. Dijak announced he's leaving WWE in a social media posted a long letter about how, you know, people in the company were telling him he was killing it at NXT, and then he was brought up to the draft, and then he was never used. They had never heard from anybody till he heard that his contract was running out from Sean Ross Sapp. I like Dijak a lot. I hope he kills it. Might actually appear on this Forbidden Door, because I don't think he has a no compete now that his contract has run out. But
he would be really useful on AEW television, because they need a big man who is formidable, who can talk, who is a presence, and he, with proper presentation, could be elevated to the level of going up against a Swerve Strickland and deliver the kind of match that you would need to merit that.
do some quick hits here, see if anything catches your ear. Baron Corbin has asked Shinsuke Nakamura to corner him for a July 26th jiu-jitsu tournament. Nakamura will be in the corner of flyweight fighter Rei Suryua at the upcoming UFC 303 event in Las Vegas on June 29th. Too Cold Scorpio, real name Charles Skaggs, was arrested on June 15th after an incident where he was working in security where he allegedly stabbed a man. His bookings in Japan for GCW and DDT have been canceled. If you want to talk about that, I can give you more info. MLW company is doing production upgrades, hires our old friend Dave Marquez as the head of production. Rhea Ripley and Buddy Matthews got married this past week. And any of those catch your ear? I can give you a little bit of background on some of them, I think.
What is
Too Cold Scorpio doing working as a security guard in a... He's working at a Love's truck stop slash convenience store, gas
right?
station.
I mean, especially being out here in Albuquerque near an area known as the War Zone, I know what those type of jobs are. Man, that sucks that he, at his age, is having to work doing one of those types of jobs, because the type of customers that are hitting those places are, being frank, the type of customers you want to have defensive protection up to and including a knife for.
Yeah.
And so I definitely want to reserve judgment on Scorpio until I know more details about the incident or whatever, because it may very well be a scenario where, yeah, he brandished a knife, but he also reasonably thought that he was in a self-defense situation.
Yeah, there's a whole write-up of the fight. He'd asked the guy to put a cigarette out, and the guy started cussing at him, and they took it outside, and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. We'll see what happens there. Numbers this week. SmackDown on June 25th, or June 21st, a show that we raved about, did its best number since the week after WrestleMania, 2,336,000 and a .73. In 18-49. Dynamite on June 26th did another low number, but up from last week. Still the second lowest in 18-49 for the year. The show did 680,000 with a .22 in 18-49. NXT, the garbage show, did 611,000 viewers with a .18 in 18-49. Raw doing 1,814,000 viewers, the .61.
I mean, I think it's good that AEW doesn't seem to be on the start of a 500,000 viewer sort of trend for Dynamite. So I last week had to give some flutters of the heart to people who want this show to be long-term successful, internally at least. And it seems as though that day has not arrived yet. So that's a good thing. But we'll talk about this AEW Dynamite, because, you know, you can't – you either are going up or you're going down when it comes to television. There's really – like, long, long, long-running products, like 10-year-plus products, settle in at a certain rating viewership, and they've completely plateaued out. The networks expect that. The viewers expect that. There's just, like, basically a base level of viewership that you can kind of have. Like the People's Court or Judge Judy. Judge Judy is never going to go on a serious ratings run, nor is it going to, like, you know, you don't have to worry about that with Judge Judy. But it's also not going to crap out. AEW is still, like, in television terms, a young program, and you have to think, if you're not going up, you're going down. And last week's number was maybe indicative of downward motion that they really don't need to be dancing with.
Judge Judy is no hot bench. Three judges, one verdict, hot bench. No. Speaking of this Dynamite, let's get into it. This is the lazy river of wrestling criticism. Whatever we watched, whatever we saw over the course of the week, we do have a Forbidden Door preview. But let's talk a little bit about this Dynamite real quick here, Chris. And I have a mini rant in me, if you do not mind.
Oh, please, go ahead.
Dear AEW, please learn the art of the hard sell. I know that over years of WWE programming that we've been... we've been kind of conditioned to really hate the amount of repetition and the amount of just flagrant plugging of things from WWE. That does not mean that we want you to do the exact opposite, which is we're going to book for Beach Blast next week in our opening segment of the show. And then to help plug Forbidden Door, what we're going to do is we're going to put on a bunch of B-list New Japan acts that are going to be appearing within Collision or our pre-show or Rampage that nobody gives a crap about. I want to hear the card from top to bottom. I want you to tell me to buy the pay-per-view. I want you to tell me how to buy the pay-per-view on TV. I want you to try and take my money for the love of God. And I want you to make these feuds feel important instead of, oh, I don't know, doing a 15-minute Kyle O'Reilly versus Zack Sabre Jr. grappling match in the middle of a damn show. It's a fine wrestling match. I get that you're booking for the sickos. I don't care. I want you to build the feuds. They started with a 30-minute segment with Daniel Garcia, who's not going to win one of these titles, I don't think, in his hometown of Buffalo, teasing that he's going to be in Wembley or that he might win the international title when he's probably not going to win either and he's going to be right back where he started from. I like Daniel Garcia. I think the dancing is stupid, but it's gotten him over. Unless they're going to belt him next week, they might, but the excuse I was giving was, well, you see, Will Ospreay will have too much on his plate and he'll be worn out, and then Daniel Garcia can beat him. Well, that's not really what you would call a strong win. Now, is it? Where he's making an excuse? If you want to push Daniel Garcia, please push Daniel Garcia. Push him to the moon. Have him beat somebody strong clean. We'll get to more about this when I talk about NXT booking, which is absolutely preposterous.
Let's say on Will Ospreay if we can.
Okay, please.
So, Will Ospreay is doing too much seems to be the story of the show right now. Insofar as I understand Will Ospreay's character, he's not focused. And that is the story that we're getting. He's focused on MJF, he's focused on Swerve, he's focused on Daniel Garcia, he's focused on having Don Callis, the worst human being in the world, as his friend still. He's focused on a number of different things. Okay, I'll go with that as the story. If that is the story, then my question to whomever is, why then do I give a shit about him having a match against Swerve Strickland when we have already written the fait accompli that Will Ospreay is going to lose this match to Swerve Strickland because he's not paying attention? Or, worse still, he beats Swerve Strickland with the overarching story that he was barely even focused on this guy as he was going in, looking past him to going into a match with Daniel Garcia. But if the story is not that Will Ospreay is spreading himself too thin, that he is not paying attention and not having his eyes on the prize, then I guess there becomes another series of questions downstream from that, like, what the hell then are you doing with the characterization of Will Ospreay? Or do you not know that you're using the same character in multiple scenes? That you write a scene and you go, oh, I don't know who should be in here. Who's talking to Daniel Garcia? Will Ospreay. I love Will Ospreay. Have him go down and talk to MJF.
Well, Will Ospreay and MJF are going to probably be at Wembley. That's probably going to be the match. And they're using Daniel Garcia in his hometown as a plot device, which is...
I'm also going to go to the meta point here. Focusing on so many matches with Will Ospreay that he's going to be having, do I really care about any of them?
Yeah, and here's the other thing to your point. He focuses, but you know when he focuses? When it's time to use the Tiger Driver 95 or whatever it is. And oh yeah, I almost hurt somebody in this match. All of a sudden now, all my focus is on not using this one move, which will cause, because that's why he's going to lose. He's going to lose because he refuses to use his one move type of a thing, which I mean, I get it as a story. I just, I sort of agree.
The other big problem here, too, is that by having all these matches already mapped out for the future, you're telling me that none of these matches are going to result in meaningful feuds.
Yes.
Not right now.
Yes. They will be set up for setup matches later or something like that. I just, this Dynamite to me felt a little desperate. Like the whole bringing out MJF, put over Daniel Garcia when you know he's not winning any of these matches, I don't think. But it felt like a, hey, we push our young stars, and I'm going to give a big pep talk right here that's really kind of a meta thing about AEW versus WWE. And then I'm going to proceed to have 2 hours of, you know, Gabe Kidd and Robbie Eagles and Tomohiro Ishii. And even though I like him, the murder grandpa and just all every single backbencher New Japan guy is going to appear on this show when nobody gives a damn about them, and you should be focusing in on this Forbidden Door card. I just, it frustrated me to no end, Chris.
Tony Storm and Mariah may have go away heat, don't care about this program in the slightest.
I liked it. I mean, it was a nice, you know, look, if we're grading on a curve, that was possibly the best segment in terms of building to the pay-per-view match that we had on this show.
I just hate the story so much. Most importantly, I'm done with the Timeless Tony Storm.
Well, who are we rooting for in this match? That's the question.
I have no idea.
Yeah.
And that becomes a recurring problem on this show, too. So at the end of all-time classic Jay White versus Phoenix, great utilization of Jay White yet again on this show, big premier signing of him, out comes Christian. Now, what is the point in building heel equity, as in building acquired hatred for a character, if I can dissipate all of it within 1 week because I'm putting my audience into an ambiguous booking situation where they don't know what the hell to feel about any of this stuff? Out comes Christian and the crowd flummoxed, flustered, baffled. How do I feel about Christian versus how do I feel about the Bullet Club Gold? Well, and I guess the thought process was, I'm trying to understand the AEW fan base better. It's an exercise in empathy that I remain committed to on a weekly basis, Jeffrey. What I can only think is that in the fans' heads there live, they looked at Austin and Colton Gunn. They were like, ooh, those guys, they're bad to their fathers. I don't like that. And then out comes Christian. And Christian is a guy who is a father, sort of. It doesn't really matter. He at least thinks fathers are good, whereas Austin and Colton Gunn, they think fathers are bad. And so the fans have now decided that Christian, guy who's basically been a heel ever since the Kenny Omega feud, like 3 years ago.
Yes.
It is a babyface all of a sudden. And the booking of the show allowed for this mistake. And I'm going to call it that because Christian Cage, especially with this character, should not be presented as the father figure. Like he's the patriarchy is not a good thing.
Right.
Conceptually or in the version of this show here on our television. So the idea that we're turning Christian Cage face questionable, that we are doing it right now for seemingly no good reason, ridiculous. If you were ever going to do it, you would do it where Christian Cage, after watching Adam Copeland get beaten within an inch of his life, finally decides that he needs to do something not devious and horrible for once in like the last 5 years here, and comes out and saves his best friend, Adam Copeland. And we finally have the heart-soaked moment where Christian turns face. I'll actually go further. This should be the only circumstance where Christian goes face, because this is kind of the big buildup. You turn him face, he goes one last match, but this time for real, and then he makes a title chase, retires. Like, he needs to stay heel indefinitely here. But AEW went to the Big Show school of booking.
I'm so fixated on you saying that. Oh, great use of Jay White when it was Phoenix who got to do absolutely nothing in that match, because I think there was some CMLL guy on the show. So it's like, yeah, we're going to send him out there to lose in this Owen tournament, but he's not allowed to do anything because we have people from the other promotion on the show, because Phoenix did jack squat against Jay White in that match. It was a Jay White squash match for the most part.
He was a premier signing. Like, Jay White, it's hard for people to remember this. He was talked about not quite at Ospreay levels when they signed him.
Is he going to go to NXT or is he going to go to AEW? Yeah,
kind of close. Kind of close. It was kind of a big deal that AEW got him and they Cesaro'd him.
Yeah. Let's get to this card and we can talk about other things within this show, because I think everything kind of hits on there. Some of these are fill-ins that I didn't realize happened, but apparently happened on the taping. So 13 matches on your Forbidden Door card. Three of them on the pre-show. It's going to be a jam band thing. Get ready. Strap in. Have popcorn. Use pause on your remote so you can go to the bathroom. All those
and
other things.
And 1.25 speed for some of these.
And 1.25 speed, yes. Chris Statlander and Momo Watanabe with Stokely Hathaway versus Willow Nightingale and Tam Nakano. Watanabe and Nakano being borrowed from Stardom, obviously, in a tag team match. Probably happens on either Rampage or Collision. Who knows? They were added. Chris, do the heels win or do the babyfaces win?
Babyfaces win.
I disagree. Heels win here. They're still going to build up Statlander for... Statlander's pinning somebody, and then it's going to get to the Statlander.
I still think Nakano... I think they do Nakano winning here to just have a feel-good moment.
Okay. We'll go with that.
Living legend.
In the Women's Owen Hart Cup tournament, first round match, Mariah May with Timeless Toni Storm, Luther, and probably Mina Shirakawa versus Saraya with Harley Cameron and Anna Jay. Let me tell you something, Chris, in that six-person match, thought Harley Cameron and Anna Jay were both better than Mariah May in the ring. That's just my personal opinion. And I think we're getting Mariah May winning this damn Owen Hart Cup, which is going to be very, very interesting. So I think she wins this match. Who do you have?
I think she wins.
Mariah May in Wembley. Okay. We'll see how that goes. Los Ingobernables de Japan. Or Japan, or Hapon, or however you say it over there. Yota Tsuji, Titan, and Hiromu Takahashi versus the Lucha Brothers, a Penta and Rey Fénix, and Mystico, which blows my mind in some way. I guess because it's on the pre-show, they can do this. I'm sitting here going, that is an actual Forbidden Door type of match. And it's on the pre-show. Okay. Who do you have winning this?
The Mystico team.
I agree. This is gonna be AAA CMLL Unity weird type of Tony Khan has thrown money at somebody, probably CMLL, and Teton's taking the fall. That's what I think.
I mean, I get it, like Sin Cara was a character that connected with a lot of us growing up.
Konosuke Takeshita versus Mark Briscoe versus Jack Perry versus Dante Martin versus Leo Rush. Almost said Leo Rush versus El Phantasmo, who I really, really like. I love El Phantasmo. Please bring him over. He's funny. In a ladder match for the vacant AEW TNT Championship, is there any chance anybody other than Jack Perry wins this thing?
It's got to be Jack Perry. It was dumb to not belt Jack Perry in the first place.
Agreed. Singles match for the AEW Women's World Title, Timeless Toni Storm versus Mina Shirakawa in a butts versus boobs match. pretty much. no, I actually think this will be pretty good, to be honest with you. I'm kind of looking forward to it. But is there any chance that that Mariah does not get involved and probably go off with Toni Storm in the end?
Yeah, I think butts win. Butts win.
I think butts win, and I think it's kind of in a gray area whether or not Mariah May meant to help Toni Storm or not, but Mariah May will probably help Toni Storm and will eventually lead to their feud once she gets the Owen Cup or whatever. The Learning Tree of Chris Jericho and Big Bill and Jeff Cobb with Brian Keith versus Samoa Joe, Hook, and Katsuyori Shibata. Oh, Chris, when they said I'm bringing somebody over from Japan, I was hoping it was Toru Yano, but no.
I know. It made me really, really upset that Jericho, especially this character, would not be enamored with the shameless self-promotion
of Toru Yano. Yes, it fits.
Yes, like that. I'm right down to there's a video sent. It should just be excerpts from the Toru Yano DVD.
Yes, it should be a DVD, and he should be going to his learning tree and say, see, all he doesn't do any moves in that ring. It's show up, get paid, sell your merch, and leave. He is the perfect learning tree guy.
He puts guys over like in the laziest ways possible.
He says that doesn't work for me, brother. That's what I want to hear Toru Yano say to somebody. But I think Joe, Hook, and Shibata win this.
I think so too. I think, especially with Jericho being spun off to other things, the Learning Tree guys are just there right now.
Yeah,
probably. Is Keith wrestling in this, or I mean?
No, he's gonna be. I think he's. Well, you know what? He's selling the arm.
He's selling the arm.
Yeah, I mean, there's a chance that he could interfere on behalf of the Learning Tree here and try and get him the win.
Yeah, right. Because Jericho now has that match against. Because
it's not like you can't pin Shibata.
No, you could pin Shibata. I mean, you shouldn't, but this is AEW.
You know what I think happens? I think Keith interferes, and I think then that's when Minoru Suzuki comes down.
Okay.
And then they tease the Chris Jericho match, and Jericho gets scared, and then somehow Jeff Cobb gets pinned out of all of it. I don't know.
Well, they beyond teased it. I mean.
Well, yeah.
Yeah, Suzuki said he's having a match against Jericho.
Yeah, so why not have him show up here? That's fine.
Yeah.
In what might be the weirdest match of the night, and yet the one that I'm most intrigued by, MJF versus Hechicero.
I mean, MJF really made me absolutely compelled to see him go up against, I believe it was a comic book villain reject. God, can't wait to see that.
I'd love to see Hechicero shoot Ben and JF. I mean, he does some such great stuff in there, but yeah, Hechicero's losing this match, and
MJF putting over this match as though it's a total afterthought. And this is the stuff about MJF that I don't care for.
You remember when he came back and he said it was nothing but hate and it was going to be super serious, and now all of a sudden he's going back to the goofy stuff like 3 weeks afterwards? God.
I know. There's no consistency in the character. All of the promos are baggy. Not everything needs to be written out note for note, but like it feels as though when we get promos on AEW television, there's almost no bullet points. It's more like a quick rejoinder before they go through the curtain of, hey, just remember, like at the end of the promo, just remember you've got a match against Hechicero on August 30th. So just if you could try to get that over, but go out there. You got 10 minutes. Have a good time out there, all right?
Both he and Will Ospreay breaking the fourth wall is what drove me nuts.
I mean, who doesn't want to see One Pump Willie go into matches now?
Oh, God. Zack Sabre Jr. versus Orange Cassidy. It'll be fun. I don't care who wins. Zack Sabre Jr. probably.
Right. I guess that's really the big point. I don't care.
Yeah, it's not that big of a blood feud. It's a match. Right? It's a match people want to see. So, right? Okay, great.
And that is always a problem a little bit with Zack Sabre Jr. is he's just a bit vanilla of a character. And when you pair that with his dance-like style of grapple technician stuff, it makes for these very wonderfully executed and totally bloodless sort of matches.
Yes.
And this is going to be kind of his slightly bloodless style with a completely heatless match. I'm going to say Orange Cassidy wins, but I don't care.
Okay. For the IWGP World Heavyweight title, John Moxley, the champion, versus Tetsuya Naito. We'll see how motivated Naito is in this one, but he's winning it, and he's taking the title back with him to Japan.
Yeah, agree.
In a match that I am very interested in, this is the match I'm interested in most on this card, Mercedes Moné versus Stephanie Vaquer, winner-take-all match for the TBS title and the New Japan Strong Women's Championship. First match was pretty good. I kind of dig Stephanie Vaquer's vibe a little bit. And I think Mercedes is motivated. I'm looking forward to this. I think Mercedes obviously wins this. And that's why Moxley is going to be doing the honors for Naito earlier in the night. So that, hey, we can have a little bit of corporate synergy here. I think Moné wants to go back, defend that strong title on a New Japan card in the Tokyo Dome. But I think this is going to be kind of a banger of a match. I'm looking forward to it.
I agree with all those sentiments. I think it's obvious that Mercedes is on a victory train right now. She's going to keep winning. And it doesn't seem like she's about to hit any resistance anytime soon. This is definitely not the point where she's taking a loss.
The Elite of Matt Jackson, Nick Jackson, and Okada versus Scissor Ace, Anthony Bowens, Max Caster, and Hiroshi Tanahashi. Those of you who complain about Nakamura just being in Orlando to surf because he enjoys surfing and he's taking it too light, owe him an apology because of what Okada and Tanahashi are going to do in this match, which is very little, to be honest with you, I think. Does Scissor Ace get the feel-good moment here? Or did the Elite?
Yeah, win? I think Scissor Ace gets the feel good moment here because we haven't built to the tag title match yet, and we need to heat up the potential that the Acclaim actually have a chance against yes. the Elite right now. And the crowd's not biting on this, and it didn't help when Billy Gunn was like, "I could kick all three of your asses by myself," but instead I'm gonna have. The people on this show routinely say things that are deeply sabotaging to other stuff that goes on. And you're like, why? How? You're Billy Gunn. You should have never had like great promo instincts, but you should have better instincts than that.
Or you should be punished for saying these things.
Right.
Stop screwing up our stories, 60-something-year-old Billy Gunn. Jeez. I had forgotten about that, but you're correct. Men's Owen Hart Cup Tournament first round match. Bryan Danielson, Vanity Tour. Bryan Danielson versus Shingo Takagi. Danielson wins. And then in what is going to be some booking intrigue, but probably not, Swerve Strickland versus Will Ospreay for the AEW World title. I had said last week that if the number was a really bad one, that Tony would entertain putting the belt on Ospreay, despite all the backlash he would get online, on Twitter, for various political reasons. Chris, is there any chance, that they go through with putting the title on Will Ospreay?
Oh, God, what a mistake. So all of those political, social, etc. reasons, and as I mentioned last week on the Juneteenth episode where Swerve Strickland also talked about going after Will Ospreay's kids, that maybe the characterization on this has not been an absolute banger the whole way down, I am going to say that trying to put the belt on Will Ospreay when he has come off as likable but unsympathetic at best leading into this build, and I would even go so far as to say slightly annoying.
Actually, they went back to that week one characterization where he was like Maverick from Top Gun, the cocky guy who's grabbing the belt and looking at the belt type thing.
Right. And last week he was family man. Don't you say yes. stuff about my kids.
Yes. I just
The characterization's been really all over the place, which is why I presented the bifurcated choose your adventure with Will Ospreay thing earlier. Because in the main event, we had Swerve Strickland establishing that he was willing to do the evil and dastardly things that it takes to be a champion in his own estimations, which includes using violence even when others think it is overwhelming or uncalled for, basically going above and beyond defeat on your opponents. And again, juxtapose that against the hero presentation that we've tried to do with Strickland at various points. I find that a confusing message. But then I also found it very confusing that Ospreay's like, oh my God, he did the thingy to the arm. I guess I'll hit the finishing move. This is too much for me. And then he grabs the belt at the end of that. Like, what is that in terms of characterization? Like, oh, I'm scared of this guy. He could hurt me. To, I'm not scared of you. I'll pick your pocket. Like, is Will Ospreay an idiot? What is this? What is this characterization? No, Ospreay, all of this is to say, no, Ospreay is not winning this title. And no, with the way they have handled Will Ospreay since they've gotten him to now, Ospreay should not win this title anytime soon. This should be the end of the Ospreay story until they figure out what the Ospreay story is. And that's pathetic.
I don't think Swerve loses it here either. I just can't see that. So let's close the door on the Forbidden Door. Go over to the Stamford area company. Main roster. The only thing we're talking about on Raw, I think, in terms of what your opinion was, that Uncle Howdy segment slash.
Oh boy, I liked it.
Did you?
Yeah, it talked back into the room. I think Bo is going to be very, very good as a character.
Bo has acting chops. I will give him that. I think my issue with it, and McAfee was off because his father-in-law died, not for in angle reason.
But I don't know about that. I think there's going to be.
They've been teasing it on the show, but I'm just saying from this week, it was in Indianapolis. And McAfee wasn't on the show because his father-in-law died. It wasn't because of Miz stunk up the joint on commentary, but nevertheless.
Although the Miz being on commentary did actually lead to a really nice piece of storytelling in terms of getting the belts off of them.
Yes.
That, like, it put Miz in a place and he had to watch an abject horror as his friend a member of the Judgment Day, R-Truth, was bamboozled by the internal politics of this group.
I liked the Bo Dallas part. I didn't like the Nikki Cross part with the VHS tape. It's like, you do such great work there to then go into the dumb, spooky theme park crap. It's like, no, keep it on kind of the creepy stuff, the edgy stuff that could be real, could be not, where he's kind of talking to himself and having doubts type of a thing. That makes... It's more interesting than a talking bird.
I think the writing's going to be there, Jeff. Yeah, I think the writing's going to be there. That even just that little line about, do you feel like you're exploiting your brother's legacy? Like,
that was a good line.
It was a good line, and it was a great moment of TV. I'm with you, Nikki Cross, all the other stuff of the Wyatt-verse doesn't really do it for me, but...
Chad Gable coming out, I'm okay! It's like, no!
I don't think he is, though. He's in denial.
Shot in the head, Chris.
Right. He was shot in the head.
You think he's in denial?
Yes. Okay. A lot of times after people get shot in the head, they win their next match. But eventually it catches up with them. So it's long-term storytelling. Anyways,
I was so mad at that. I was so mad that he came out and goes, rumors of my demise are greatly exaggerated. No.
I now back in the let's see where this is going camp, and you know I hate being.
Is Canny coming out? Is Canny? Let's see how this plays out.
My boy Canny is speaking louder. It's funny. I don't hear his voice as much ever since I stopped drinking.
Yes.
But right now he's louder. He's as loud as he's been in over 6 months. Oh, yes. I do. I do. In fact, hear the voice of Canny saying, let's see how this plays out. Because I think Bo Dallas is strong enough that it makes it worth it. I think with Chad Gable, what we're getting a tease that he's going to recruit the Creeds, but they're not. I think that's a red herring.
He's going to be a talking turtle.
No, he's going to get sucked. He's going to get sucked
in Wyatt Six.
Into the Wyatt Six, exactly.
Yeah, what animal is he going to be? He's going to be a turtle. He's going to be Gable the turtle.
And I also think the storytelling with McAfee, now that I'm starting to see it come together, makes so much sense. They did a really good job with this, where Cole's always like, oh, that thing's weird. And then every week, McAfee's like, yeah, I went back to my room and I was watching it. And like we kind of move past it in the show. But if you actually think about like the McAfee character off screen, imagine him in the hotel room like 12 in the morning, still watching the weird video from the Wyatts, you know, like scanning the QR code. He's been getting red pilled, essentially.
He's going to be conspiracy minded Pat McAfee.
Right.
It's Always Sunny meme where he has like a board and like thread.
This is the thing though that I really enjoy about the Raw universe now. And this is also true of the SmackDown universe, but I feel like Raw, like SmackDown's really established that with the Bloodline and then has kind of worked it out from there. Whereas it feels like with Raw, when they figured out what they were doing with the Judgment Day, it's like a lot of other pieces started to fit together around this puzzle. And you get these characters that have been built over weeks and months who now have these motivations where if you stop and you think like, oh, why is this person doing that or whatever? It's very entertaining. Another great moment of this week was the Dominic Mysterio segment where he's in the ring trying to break up Liv Morgan and Zelina Vega and has the interaction with Rey where he like pushes over Rey, and then later backstage, because he was originally out there to stop Liv, later backstage when Liv comes up to him, he's always like, I hate my dad. He's a deadbeat. then we circle back to Rey Mysterio as deadbeat dad.
Yeah.
Drew McIntyre, same thing. We've been telling a story for weeks and weeks with him. Braun Breaker, same idea. We've been telling a story for weeks and weeks about this guy and the way that he rubs everybody the wrong way. I mean, I think he comes up short in this match against Sami Zayn because he's pissed too many people off.
Hmm. Chris, how many combined tickets in Canada do you think that Sean Spears and Ethan Page are selling for NXT Heatwave as Canadian attractions? And is the over-under zero on that?
Oh, God, I was going to say upwards of a good – I mean, are they in either two? One of their hometowns?
I don't believe either are from Toronto proper, which is the site of the next NXT.
Well,
I understand this.
How close are they to one of their hometowns? Could like either one of them pay to bus in some friends?
I believe Sean Spears is Calgary, and I believe that Ethan Page is Edmonton, but don't quote me on that.
Well, one of them make a call to Bret Hart and see if Bret Hart would show up at that.
Well, no, Bret Hart showing up to Dax Harwood's 40th birthday in North Carolina. So I don't think
Brett's not available.
My point is, this is going to be a four-way, I think, for Trick Williams' title. And I like Sean Spears and I like Ethan Page. I don't like either of them beating Javon Evans and Trick Williams over and over and over again to lead to a four-way where they don't really matter and one of them's taking the pin and you don't think either of them are going to win this title, etc., etc. Why? It's the Daniel Garcia problem from which I was saying, if you're going to push young guys. Let's do this. Let's go all the way with it. If you're afraid they can't work, then you put them in with the veteran guys and you give the title to the veteran and you let him chase for a while, which is what they should have done last. Now we're going to have a four-way where we have two guys who we don't trust to have a one-on-one match in terms of Trick Williams and Javon Evans. Oh, but we need to put them in with these ring generals of Ethan Page and Sean Spears to work them through. But now you've also made the degree of difficulty exponential by having a four-way. We're going to have a lot of set pieces and people need to be in the right place instead of just having a match where people tell a story one-on-one. I'm livid at this NXT because they built up such goodwill with us over the week. Like, the one thing that popped me on NXT was Ariana Grace and her shenanigans before the match when Sol Ruka was coming in. She's perfect. Can't wait to see her with Chelsea Green on the main roster. She's a great comedy figure, but everything else on this show, I hated. I don't want Damon Kemp breaking up with the No Quarter Catch crew because Tavion Heights is the quote-unquote new guy and splitting them up. We're just making no sense with a lot of the booking on this show for me, Chris.
Yeah, I feel the same way. I don't care for the booking on this. Look, Ethan Page should be the champion. Right now, I think the best case scenario is that our four-way main event at TakeOver is actually a set piece where Sean Spears and Ethan Page are actually in cahoots and they get the belt on Ethan Page. But that does not excuse the idiotic booking of Javon Evans. What is the point of giving him these high-profile wins only for him to have them erased either by the booking patterns or by his own stupid decisions? So I don't know what that says about him. Trick Williams remains a weak champion. There's just no two ways around it. He's not strong on the mic. He doesn't have a strong look, and he's not strong in the ring. And Sean Spears, no one takes him seriously as a title contender. So him and Evans really feel like two guys who are just there. This is subtraction by addition into the storyline. This is a very basic story to me of Ethan Page is here. He hates Trick Williams, doesn't think the guy's a worthy champion. Trick Williams is trying to prove that he's a worthy champion. Either he does or he does but gets screwed and loses the title. These are the two stories that you should be telling, and you're not telling them with these guys here. I think Kalani Jordan's promo style is very strange, and I can't tell if she's a face or a heel in certain ways.
It's very scripted, and she's not doing well with the scripting, but she's a baby face.
Yeah. Lola, I think they at least made the back fist spot make more sense on this week's television, so I'll give them that. Still was not a great spot last week. And also, I kind of think she should beat Roxanne here.
Let's see how they do the go home, and then I'll be able to decide whether or not what they're doing. We'll do a preview of that next week.
Damon Kemp and Tavion Heights was like fine. Like, the exchanges were good, but I don't necessarily, I'm with you. I don't like what they're doing with No Quarter Catch crew
I hate it.
Pretty much top. They are the opposite of the Judgment Day, where you theoretically have all the pieces there in terms of entertainment and wrestling quality, and all the characters are absolutely terrible.
Yes.
Oba Femi's also running out of steam. Like, the one promo that he does of, like, I am a mighty champion. Like, that is basically his promo every single time. And
We're running in place with who he's feuding with because, we're going to bring back Wes Lee, but we still have Joe Coffey in the mix. I think Joe Coffey is going to screw Wes Lee in this last chance match. And then we're just going to be back in step one because they're afraid of what to do with Oba Femi because they don't really know what to do with Oba Femi, I think.
And yeah, right. And he's not really dominating anyone. I mean, it really, this should be a scenario where Oba Femi decides for himself he just wants to face Wes Lee, and the way he's going to do that is just by beating the crap out of all the Gallus guys. Basically, like, 3-on-1 handicap match, and he wins.
Yeah.
That should be... And that should be the build for Wes Lee going into the TakeOver event here, is that Oba Femi took care of the other opponent, all three of them. What is Wes Lee going to do?
Let's end with Vader Club. Introduce us to your choice here, Chris.
Alrighty, so I chose a man who is a mainstay on Virtual Pro Wrestling 2, and my Virtual Pro Wrestling 2 character, Dr. Nove, has had many a match against him. One, Gary Albright. He shows up a lot of times in my tag team struggles, too, with Vader, often on the BPW games. Well, if I was going to have a tag team partner, who else would it be? Also, I'd manage Vader, that, like, clearly. I'd be like his kind of crappy tag team partner who gets beat up, and then Vader comes in and saves my butt. Anyways, the match that we watched was Toshiaki Kawada, Eddie Kingston's favorite wrestler, versus Gary Albright from October 25th, 1995. Rated by none other than the great Dave Meltzer at 4.25 stars. It is, in my opinion, 15 minutes of pure bliss. And I think it serves as a really nice distillation of the difference between strong style, like we get on TV these days, and King's Road style of the 1990s, where everything looks like it effing hurts, probably because it does, but it's not as heavily, it's not a heavy emphasis on no selling. If anything, one of the highlights of this match for me, from both Albright and Kawada, were in the quality of the sells. You had really great selling of the limbs. Both of them had to sell shoulder and or arm damage at various points, took a powder to the outside of the ring, had to recollect themselves. At one point, Gary Albright hits Kawada with just an incredible German suplex, folds him up like an accordion, and Kawada gets up like he is doing the strong style no-sell, and then like a super punch-out character, stumbles out of the ring in his dizzy spin and ends up in a heap on the floor. It is so masterfully done.
Chris can vouch for this. I popped hard for that cell. So, cause we were watching it together. I just absolutely lost my mind on that cell, even though I've seen people do similar ones. The way that Kawada did it looked real, and I just absolutely adored it.
Yeah. It served as a testimony to the importance of selling to get offense over for a fan base. Like that, strong selling, strong style selling doesn't actually as effectively get over how murderous a suplex is, yes, or how murderous an enziguri is, as does an attempted strong sell that results in an actual sell. That much, much more effective. And that actual sells always trump strong style sells, in my opinion, no matter what. Kawada, of course, if you are familiar with his work, does all of his great stiff ass kicks and then
murder kicks. Those are just murder kicks.
And then talking about the man, Gary Albright here. Gary Albright showing up to this match clearly at his college weight. I am being extremely facetious here. Gary Albright seems to be about plus 40 pounds, and they all appear to be in his midsection, leading to a very interesting sort of body shape on the guy that actually lends to his weird grappling menace.
Yeah.
That this guy has really long and gangly limbs, clearly has a wrestler's body underneath there, and now has this very formidable center of mass with which he can toss you around from. And Gary Albright uses that a lot. I think he does lots of great leverage moves throughout here. A lot of his reverses to get to the back grapple are really nicely done. And I enjoy that Albright does a combination, like he is primarily a wrestler, but there's this part of him that wants to brawl. But every time he tries to do that against Kawada, he sorely regrets it because Kawada's actually a brawler who does some occasional wrestling in submissions. And that story of the styles is told throughout the match.
And there's a part of him that wants to be a judoku. Or judoka, or whatever you say. Yeah. Because he likes doing his throws. He loves his little leverage throws. The spot that we also really, really liked, and it's something that a lot of, like, the full Nelson spot when he's on the ground, yes, and you're using the leverage there. Like, when American companies give a guy with the full Nelson, there's no real violence to it. I mean, it's a strength spot, like you had Masters and Lashley do it. The most I've seen somebody be really violent, like Billy Jack Haynes used to like put on the full Nelson and shake you around kind of a thing. But you were never on the ground getting rubbed, your face rubbed in the mat with a full Nelson like Gary Albright did here. And it was friggin' awesome. And it really like when you watch 80 squash matches, like you get a lot of the, okay, here's a guy who can grapple, but he's also screwing with a young kid and rubbing his face in the mat type of a thing. That's what this was like for me.
Yeah. So if you go back to the classic Vince notes about submission holds, the reason we never get this type of full Nelson, it would directly fly in the face of the Vince rule of we must always see your face when you're in a submission hold.
Yes.
But the whole point of this submission hold to me, and actually what gets over the agony and the demoralization of it, is you just see dude, hands behind head, just staring at the mat. No hope. It's just an ocean of canvas between you and the ropes. And you're in the middle of the ring on your belly, complete loss of the arms. Mm-hmm. And you have a guy like Gary Albright carrying that extra weight, just putting it all straight on your back. There is a real level of hopelessness to the trapped nature of this type of hold that I do think is sorely missed. I this is a really good match. It's not long. I mean, it's 15 minutes, so it's not short, but it's not like 45 minutes in the Tokyo Dome or anything right. like that. It is real. It's just good. And I also love, initially, they're kind of respecting each other's powder breaks, but I like when the respect for the powder breaks down. And like Albright goes out and just like rams over Kawada. And then later Kawada like sees Albright favor the shoulders, like, cool. Just kicks
him right in the shoulder. Just kicks him right in the shoulder. Yeah, I think next week, Vader Club, I'm going to rewatch this and then I'll confirm to you. But I'm thinking it's going to be Benoit Malenko versus the Tasmaniac and Sabu from Return of the Funker. ECW, I think that's 1995. I'll send you a link for it. So watch that in anticipation, kids. If it's as good as I remember it, we'll be watching that. It's been Shake Them Ropes. I am Jeff Hawkins. You can follow me on the socials at CrapGame13. You can just follow the show at Shake Them Ropes, all one word. If you want to follow Chris on his one social thing, it's only Instagram at DOCTOR_NOV. We are part of the Voices of Wrestling Podcasting Network podcast for all of your niche wrestling loves. I also work for Fight Game Media. I do a show called The Dynamite Show. Wednesday nights, about 20 minutes afterwards, Paul Fontaine and myself go live, deconstruct all things AEW, drops in your podcatchers the next morning. Chris has various interests, and he will teach you music if you so incline.
Yeah, if you like music, I like music. I'm actually doing a lecture on the post-punk band Wire this Sunday. It is starting at 11 a.m. Mountain Standard Time. That is 1 p.m. on the East Coast and 10 a.m. on the West Coast.
I was told there'd be no math, Chris, but yes.
There's always math. The whole world in its way is made up of numbers, as is music, and we'll be discussing all of that in this week's lecture on Wire, focusing in on Pink Flag and Chairs Missing. If you are interested in guitar lessons, I'm interested in teaching them. So please hit me up on the Instagram if you are so moved, so inclined. It is kind of what I am doing these days. And other than that, I just want to remind everyone that you need to get your oil checked every 3,000 miles if you're using regular, but every 5,000 if you're using synthetic. But when summer comes around, always a good time to check your oil. It's hot out there, people. Let's take care of our autos.
And hot weather will kill your battery. So check that too.
And it'll kill you.
Hi, I'm Case Lowe, co-host of the Open the Voice Gate podcast. The one question I'm constantly asked when it comes to Dragon Gate is, how do I get into the promotion? Well, stop asking and start listening to the Open the Voice Gate podcast, released every Wednesday on the Voices of Wrestling Podcasting Network. For exclusive news and show reviews, look no further than the leader in Dragon Gate coverage, Open the Voice Gate.